Peter B. Collins News and Comments. It's Monday, November 2nd, 2020. That makes it Election Eve. As Americans are rushing out to buy guns and firewater to hunker down, we're all pretty nervous about what comes on November 4th. And the weekend hasn't really provided much to calm people's nerves, because we've seen a lot of public incidents involving Trump supporters. The man himself has gone pretty far off the deep end, reverting to an entire litany of lies to try to deflect from COVID. And the polls have been tightening. And I'll give you a quick rundown, but I have to offer this caveat. That as someone who leans left, has never supported Trump in any meaningful way, oh, a few issues, I've said, you know, I could go along with him on certain matters. But I'm one of those people who predicted back 4 years ago that Trump was likely to win. And this year, I have no such confidence in predicting the outcome of this contentious race. And some of it is my own bias that I don't find Joe Biden to be a compelling, engaging figure. Most people are voting against Trump, not voting for Biden. And also, I'll use a metaphor from electronics. It comes from the idea of the signal-to-noise ratio. Any kind of an audio signal has a certain amount of noise, right? But if the signal is loud enough, it overcomes the noise and you're able to get the message. But the noise of these tightening polls, the voter suppression, the back and forth between the candidates, the media suppression of the Hunter Biden allegations, and the way that racism and other forms of hate have been unleashed, it makes it very difficult to predict. And front and center, the voter suppression, the ballot rejection of the large volume of mail-in ballots that some may never arrive if the Postal Service can't get its shit together. It's a big, big, hot, steaming mess. So, you want some comfort? Nate Cohn over at the New York Times, as we pointed out last week, has two sets of numbers. One are the current polling results in key states, and the other is adjusted to factor in how wrong the polls were in 2016. Now, I don't know the math magic that was used to develop that second set of numbers, but it'll encourage some people and leave others just kind of on the edge of their seats. So, New Hampshire, which is not a very important state, Biden is up by 11. If the polls were wrong, as they were in 2016, he'd still be up by 8. In Wisconsin, which very much matters, Biden is showing a 10-point advantage over Trump. Adjusted for 2016 polling errors, that is a plus 4, which is a tie, if you consider the margin of error of a statewide poll. Then in Minnesota, Biden is up by 10, plus 4 if you factor in 2016. Michigan, Biden up by 8, but it's only 4 if you factor in 2016. Now, Nevada is slightly different. The polls currently are showing a 6-point advantage for Biden, and if you adjust them for 26, it would be an 8-point advantage. Okay, I'll take it. Pennsylvania, Biden plus 6, but adjusting for the errors of 2016, it is a mere 1-point advantage, which is below the margin of error. Nebraska, Biden is up by 5. It'd be plus 9 in the 2016 process. Maine, Biden is up plus 4, but it would be plus 9 with the 2016 adjustment. Arizona, plus 4 for Biden in the current polling, plus 2 if you factor in 2016. So it is so close. that it is within the margin of graft, as I have often described it, and we've got a graft and grifter in the White House who has a team of people who are racketeering with him. They are co-conspirators to steal this election, to do whatever it takes to enable a claim of victory that could be upheld by the even more friendly than ever United States Supreme Court. But Nate Cohn says it's possible the polls could be off by even more than they were 4 years ago. But to win, that's exactly what Trump needs. He would need polls to be even worse than they were in the northern battleground states 4 years ago. Crucially, he would also need polls to be off to a far greater extent at the national level, as well as the Sun Belt. And those polls have been relatively accurate in recent contests. But when I look at Florida, which is a virtual tie, and Texas, which is a virtual tie, number one, I do not have any confidence that Texas is ready to flip to Democratic preferences. And number two, it is so close in Florida, with a Republican-controlled state government that is willing to do whatever Trump asks them to forestall the tide turning to Biden. Now, the undecideds are under 5%, and they include minor party voters in that number. And so we don't know if those voters will make a difference. So we have a virtual tie. And depending on the last-minute shifts and which voters choose to go to the polls, there are still some people who are holding absentee ballots who could show up at the poll tomorrow and turn that in and vote at the polls. And we expect hundreds of thousands of mail-in ballots to be rejected because they don't arrive in time, they don't have the right signatures, people didn't use the right pen. And the Republicans will be very aggressive in critical states to try to get as many Democratic ballots rejected as possible. Will the Democrats play the same hardball game? Well, history does not encourage confidence in that idea. So we have 97 million Americans who've already voted. That's more than two-thirds of the total who turned out in 2016. We do expect higher turnout. So roughly a third of the people may vote at the polls. And this is going to produce no result on election night. And so, what will happen? Well, we expect Trump to get on his Twitter, either late Tuesday night or early Wednesday, and demand that the vote counting be stopped, particularly if he is ahead. And he'll declare that every mail-in ballot in the country is illegitimate and must be scrapped. Or something like that. So the Biden campaign is getting its chin up. The manager, Jennifer O'Malley Dillon, asserted, under no scenario will Donald Trump be declared a victor on election night. When Trump says that ballots counted after midnight should be invalidated, he's just making that up. There is no historical precedent that any of our elections have ever run and been counted and completely verified on election night. We do not expect that to happen in 2020. And so what's Jack Dorsey going to do? He's the guy who runs Twitter. He laid out a rule that anybody who tries to claim falsely about the nature of the vote tabulation? Is he going to block him or is he going to flag it to make it more exciting for his 20 to 80 million Twitter followers to get his message? So Bob Bauer, who is the lawyer who worked on the Obama elections, he's back at the top of the legal team for Biden. And Bauer said that Trump's suggestions that he will raise legal challenges are a lot of hot air. He said the case he's turning over to his lawyers when the voters have spoken is a case that no lawyer can win. And his lawyers will not win it, so we're going to match them, I assure you, and exceed them in quality and vigor, and we'll protect the vote. Well, I love the rhetoric. Show me the action. That's what we need to see. Meanwhile, in Pennsylvania, which everybody knows is one of the most critical states, both campaigns have been crisscrossing the state. I think Trump's been there like 8 times in the last week. And his campaign has also made a demand of a central Pennsylvania county. An email was received by the election officials in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, for Cumberland County, on behalf of Donald J. Trump for president. They have questions, 24 questions, regarding your office's compliance with existing statutes and law, demanding a response by 5 p.m. the next day. The questions included security issues that nobody should publicly answer, like where ballots and voting machines would be stored after polls closed, including address and room number. Hey, how about the combination to the room, huh? So is this where the Proud Boys are supposed to swarm? And Trump issued one of those ominous statements over the weekend about Philadelphia. He said, we all know about Philadelphia. But I know I'm not the only one who's saying, huh? What about Philadelphia? This is a den of iniquity. This is where Democrat operatives, I'm using his language. They never say Democratic. So Democrat evil operatives in these Democrat-controlled cities in the dark of night are going to manipulate the vote count? He never specifies. But in one of his mob rallies over the weekend, he insisted, the whole world and our nation is going to be waiting and waiting and waiting to hear who won. You're going to be waiting for weeks, he asked his crowd of loving fans. He said, we have to know who won. We have to know who won. He loves to repeat things, you know. And he said that the shift to mail-in ballots is a terrible thing they've done to our country. And then he dings the United States Supreme Court that he's been busy packing with his allies. He said, I'm talking about the Supreme Court. It's a terrible, political, horrible decision that they made. We're going to be waiting. November 3rd is going to come and go, and we're not going to know. And we're going to have bedlam in our country. And you're going to have this period of 9 days or 7 days or whatever it is, and many bad things. Ballots are going to be, oh, we just found 10,000 ballots. Oh, that's good. We just found another 10,000. This is a horrible thing the United States Supreme Court has done to our country. And I say it, and I say it loud, and I say it proud. Was he channeling James Brown? Say it loud. Say it proud. So, this is where the noise has been turned up to a deafening level. The din is so extreme that it's hard to think straight. It's hard to calculate, even with fuzzy math, about what is likely to happen here. And then we go to Texas, where over the weekend, the state Supreme Court resisted a challenge coming from Republicans to 127,000 ballots that were cast in Harris County by people who were in their cars. And this kind of drive-in, drive-up voting is something that's got to be stopped because because Democrats vote from their cars. It's been incoherent. But let me start with the very latest breaking news that and one reason I'm recording the podcast just a little bit late today is this broke as I was preparing to record. A federal judge in Houston has rejected the third effort by Republican leaders to invalidate those 127,000 votes that were cast at drive-through locations in Harris County. That's Houston. The lawsuit was one of the most aggressive moves by Republicans in an election marked by more than 400 voting-related lawsuits. We can't even keep track of them all. And some of them may have made subtle changes that we won't really recognize until well after the election is packed up, and then we have the luxury of breaking down what happened. Judge Andrew Hanen, a federal judge appointed by George W. Bush, held an emergency hearing for the lawsuit today. So that is good news. And I'll save us a little time here just by condensing what I had planned to cover about the Texas effort. Because fundamentally, once again, it's an effort to block people from participating in what is left of our democratic process. And this decision to use 10 drive-through voting sites in Houston was approved unanimously by the county commissioners. It was tested in a pilot program over the summer. And what's the difference? Who cares where you vote? If you're in a tent in a parking lot, sitting in your car, that is somehow onerous when, you know, you walk into a school auditorium and stand in front of a silly little booth where you don't really need curtains, but some people have them, as if they're dressing rooms. So I'm glad the Democrats fought this. These are the most desperate efforts we've seen to block people's right to vote. This is a direct impact of the Roberts Court's decision to upend the enforcement section of the Voting Rights Act back in 2014, claiming that, hey, our elections are all so transparent that we don't need to be able to regulate the rules of states that change them to suppress participation. And it is so obvious, so painfully obvious, as the court shifts even further to the right with the handmaid herself, Amy Coney Barrett. Now, in addition, over the weekend, Harris County did something that I've never seen before. They opened 8 or 10 polling locations, 24 hours. And as many as 800 people who work different shifts and told reporters they would otherwise not been able to have voted. They showed up at 3 a.m., at 4 a.m. to cast their ballots. And what's wrong with that? I mean, the Republicans didn't challenge that part. I'm sure they would if they thought they had even a thread that they could pull on. And there's an interesting op-ed about this issue by Stephen Vladek. He is a professor at UT Law. And he makes some interesting contextual comments about this effort. And he noted that the Republican plaintiffs waited until last week to bring this federal suit. And it's unclear how these plaintiffs, or anyone else for that matter, are injured by having eligible voters cast timely ballots. And under something called the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine, lawsuits like this in which someone who lost in state court brings the same identical suit against the same party in federal court, that's supposed to be barred. And I don't know if that is the reason that the federal judge rejected the case today. So the antics of Trump supporters over the weekend reached a new level of concern. And there are many people who are quite worried that we're going to have blood on the streets in the next few days. And I don't want to fan those flames. I don't want to heighten the concerns that people have. I don't want to exaggerate the risk. And at the same time, we cannot dismiss it. We must be vigilant. We must reject any kind of over-the-top effort by Trump's Proud Boys or other armed elements to intimidate or force an improper result on the American public. So Saturday, in North Carolina, near Greensboro, The town is called Alamance. The county sheriff's deputies and the police in the town of Graham pepper sprayed people, including a 5-year-old girl and other children, who were marching to the polls on Saturday afternoon. This was an interracial group of about 200 people who left the Wayman's Chapel AME Church, and they were marching to Court Square. And at a certain point, after they held a moment of silence in the street to honor George Floyd, the cops had had enough. They told people to clear the road, they forced people onto the sidewalk, and they first began spraying pepper spray in their direction, aimed at the ground. And I have a picture here where the cops are using this industrial-grade pepper spray. You know, you aim this canister and it could go 12, maybe even 15 feet, longer than a COVID sneeze. And this is just absurd. Now, I want to be clear that I'm not saying that these sheriffs and town cops were doing this at Trump's behest. But they certainly were not supporting people's right to vote, people's right to assemble, people's right to speak freely. And I don't know the particulars about whether these folks failed to get a permit or not, but there are several local elected officials who were marching with this crowd of 200. And so we have to look at this in a fairly skeptical way. So then we have the cases of the Trumpers in Texas on Friday. And a group of them formed a caravan. Of course, it's a safe caravan because it doesn't have any of those dangerous migrants from Guatemala hoping to come to the United States for asylum and a brighter future. No. These are American assholes. A lot of them with pickup trucks, flying Trump and Confederate flags simultaneously. And this caravan followed a Biden-Harris campaign bus. And it turns out that Kamala Harris was not on the bus at that time. But they surrounded it and they played chicken with it. Essentially, these MAGA maniacs in their pickup trucks tried to run this bus off the road. In doing so, there was a collision between one of the MAGA vehicles and an unsuspecting driver who was just heading down the interstate. And that's not an isolated incident. We'll get to the others in a moment. And what is also not isolated is that Trump sees his thugs as doing beautiful things. And when he heard that the FBI has routinely announced they're going to investigate these reports, I think it should actually be the Secret Service, because they have jurisdiction over the campaign bus. At any rate, Trump tweeted, "In my opinion, these patriots did nothing wrong. The FBI and justice should be investigating the terrorists, anarchists, and agitators of Antifa who run around burning down our Democrat-run cities and hurting our people." So there we go with another case of Trump projection. There are no recent events involving Antifa. There have been a couple of minor looting events in Philadelphia and in Portland. Antifa has not claimed responsibility for any of those incidents. And Antifa isn't really a thing, as rational people understand. So he also said that that report of an FBI investigation was false. But that doesn't seem to be the case, because it was the FBI that said it was investigating. They don't usually mislead about things like that. And I'm no fan of the FBI. So the idea that you can intimidate the opponent, the idea that it's okay to run them off the road with vehicles manned by, in many cases, armed idiots, this is a new low in America. And this is Trump's America. And yet, there are so many people who just laugh at this incident It's another episode of owning the libtards. And this is another part of the noise that I have referenced here repeatedly. And that is that so many right-wingers who are captive to Fox News, One America News, Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, they deeply believe, they have been brainwashed, that people like you and me are a threat to America. And they don't want to just beat us at the polls. They want to vanquish us. And while they don't make direct threats to kill us, they don't object to that, because they have been convinced that we are pure evil. And by being left of center, however you define yourself, I'm not a Democrat, as you know. I'm more liberal. I'm more left than the Democratic Party. But they view everyone to the left of the right, first as liberal, then as socialist, and socialist is the same as communist in their muddled brains. And communists deserve to be killed because the Cold War, hey, it's back and bigger and better than ever. And that is one of the underlying elements of the noise that I refer to that makes it very difficult to predict the outcome, if there is one, and when we might see it. What will be the nature of the post-election legal challenges by Trump and company? Will they be successfully defeated by Democrats? We are in some ways falling off a cliff, starting on Wednesday morning, because somewhere from there forward, we can expect these maneuvers from Trump. Will it include a call to the Proud Boys to stop standing by and to hit the streets? These are legitimate concerns. So, in addition to the confrontation on the roads in Texas, Trump caravans halted traffic on the Garden State Parkway in New Jersey. They jammed the Cuomo Bridge between Tarrytown and Nyack, New York. A pro-Trump convoy in Virginia ended an intense shouting match with protesters as it approached a statue of Robert E. Lee in Richmond. In Georgia, a rally for Democrats was canceled shortly before it was to start on Sunday because they feared a large militia presence drawn by Trump's own event nearby. Here in marvelous Marin County, California, Trumpers, mostly with pickup trucks, mostly with flags flying, they kind of drove aimlessly around the county on Sunday, and then they decided to go visit the one black community neighborhood called Marin City. And you have to just imagine, because I don't have any declaration from them about why this was their destination. But they went to harass and intimidate African Americans, who are a sharp minority in this area to begin with. And it's just a blatant indicator of how they think. They view their targets as enemies. And they are using some of the tactics of the Black Lives Matter protests of the summer, which they deplored when they were used by African Americans. So, this is just kind of a preview, a warm-up. And he has such a hold on his cult members that they do appear to be willing to bring their weapons and use them. And Jason Miller, a spokesman for the Trump campaign, he deflected all these questions. He claimed the Democrats expect Trump to be ahead on election night, and then they're going to try to steal it back after the election. So in their minds, the clock ticks midnight on election day, and the election is over. We've never had a case where the election had a final count. It's all been projections by the networks based on exit polls. Exit polls are not relevant this year because not as many people are going to the polls. And so we're going to survive. In 2000, it took until mid-December for the Supreme Court to render its judgment on the election. We didn't have riots in the streets or these kinds of incidents. So Miller also deflected questions about the highway disruptions by Trump supporters, saying he was more concerned with downtown Washington businesses have to board up their windows in anticipation of lawless, violent Biden supporters rioting and looting on Wednesday night. Huh? Now I want to thank Dick Attlee from Maine. He forwarded a report from Fordham University's Law Center. Issued today, the National Guard Bureau has reportedly established a new unit made up mostly of military policemen that could be dispatched to help quell potential election-related unrest in the coming days. The unit could also be used to respond to natural disasters or other missions. It was formed in September and initially described as a rapid reaction force. National Guard officials have recently started referring to them as regional response units, based on roles that they've already had this year. The National Guard members, who are organized within each state and territory and commanded by their governor, could be called upon to perform crowd control, safeguard landmarks, or enforce curfews. And Homeland Security is planning to ramp up to protect federal property. And while they've noted that Homeland Security has limited authorities regarding physical security of federal property, we know that didn't bother them a whit in Portland this summer when they were deployed as Trump's personal palace guard. And speaking of Portland, they're gearing up to avoid using any of those federal goons who apparently still are billeted in Portland. They're just not patrolling or showing their faces. So the governor, Kate Brown, in a move that eliminates the federals, but it also bypasses Portland's recently imposed ban on the use of tear gas, the governor announced that the state police and the county sheriff's office will take over command of the response in Portland during this election week. And with Portland police reporting to the Unified Command, it allows state police and sheriff deputies to bypass the directive banning Portland police from using tear gas. And Kate Brown, the governor, says, we hope that it won't be used or only in extreme circumstances. There was an incident of intimidation of voters at a park in Springfield on Sunday. There is a report that there was an absentee ballot drop box in a park where a group of armed individuals from Patriotic Trump 2020 Make Oregon Red, and that people who attempted to drop their ballots while the rally was underway were subject to interference by armed members of this right-wing protest group. Also, Portland is still on edge because last Thursday, a black man named Kevin Peterson Jr., age 21, was shot. Now, the police version of this is that the former high school football player, who's the recent father of a baby daughter, that he was in a parking lot when police approached him. He was suspected of selling illegal drugs. It's a motel parking lot. He fled on foot, the cops said. They reported the man produced a handgun. The officers backed off, and a short time later, the man encountered three Clark County deputies, all of whom fired their pistols at the man. They didn't say that the man fired a handgun found at the scene, making it unclear what happened just before the shooting. We have no word about body cameras or other details of the incident, including how many shots were fired and if that deadly force was justified. And often we know police make up stories about incidents like this, so we do have to await actual evidence. But this is Vancouver, Washington, which is about 12 miles north of Portland. And after the incident became public, there was a protest. A group of hundreds of protesters marched through downtown Vancouver. Windows were shattered, flags were burned, federal agents in riot gear surrounded a building, warning people that trespassing would make them subject to arrest. Well, we need to hear more about what really occurred there. And Paul Leto, our correspondent in Seattle, dropped me a note with this opinion. He said, something like this is the best possible framing going into Election Day. Please don't let yourself be gut-punched tomorrow night. Twice as many Republicans will vote in the polls, which always get counted first. Trump has promised bedlam if later counts start to reverse initial results because he knows that is what will happen. Mailed ballots always get counted after Election Day. Trump also says his lawyers will sue the day after. We will see a week or two of bedlam and perhaps violence to stop the counts. I will be so happy to be wrong, but I doubt I will be. So I don't want anybody to feel gut-punched or victorious when results won't fully be known until mid-November. And even that may be optimistic, Paul. Celebrating or crying on election night assumes the counts on election night from the polls will be representative, when they definitely won't be. The pandemic and vote by mail means it will take a week or two. And I think, you know, if it's as close as things look, it could be even longer than that. Every day I pause to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Mary Vogt, Jason Ferguson, Peter Hoffmeister, and Janet Price. They've been contributing to help support me, and as you know, I'm going to be winding down the podcast once we have a resolution to the election. I plan to go for a week or two after we know what the results are, and I also have some plans to catch up with some of my favorite guests for a final interview, and all that will play out. I do want to invite you to cancel your subscriptions, and because PayPal will not allow me to cancel them from my side of the digital divide, it is up to you to go to PayPal and cancel your subscription, your payment order for the Peter B. Collins Podcast. And I am refunding any automatic renewals that are happening, particularly with the $50 annuals, and we'll try to wind this down as seamlessly as possible. But do understand that if in any case you want to ask for a refund, just email me, and we will take care of that without any argument. And I deeply appreciate the support of so many people all over the world for so many years here at peterbcollins.com. And the website will remain up. All of the existing podcasts and archives will be available. I'm just going to be backing away from the news treadmill and seeing what else enters my life. I don't have a big plan. I had wanted to travel, but we're not allowed to do that now. There are no countries that'll let me in. And so I'm just going to go for a bit of a shift in my life, and I'm open to what happens next. And I do include the possibility of returning to occasional podcasts. If I do, anybody who is in my current subscription list, you'll get an email notice if I resume podcasting or if I put up a special. And I'll announce other ways that you can make sure you're on my email list as we get closer to the wind down. So I remain troubled by the corporate media's effort to shut down what is clearly a political stunt, an October surprise, the dropping of political dirt very close to the election, and I'm referring to the Giuliani scheme, the Hunter Biden laptop, and the way the corporate media has played this. And let me set the stage. Front page, Sunday's New York Times. The whole issue is reduced to a media story that Fox and Breitbart and other right-wing echo chambers are promoting what the corporate media dismisses just a total pack of lies. And in order to get there, you have to do incredible backflips to ignore the history of Hunter Biden, James Biden, who is Joe's brother, and you have to trust the candidate, Joe Biden, that he is telling the truth and always has about his son's business enterprises. And so the Times started on the front page, and it jumps to a full page in the center of the first section. And it basically says that this is just another cheap shot by Rudy Giuliani, who is a disgusting guy. I mean, I've found Rudy Giuliani detestable since well before 9/11. I think he is odious, with a capital O. And the Times notes, while the president has promoted the material relentlessly, many of the Trump-friendly news outlets and other organizations that sustained the effort 4 years ago have been diminished or sidelined. Their 2020 replacements have had less reach, and the anti-Biden material that they have been pumping out has been met with heightened skepticism from traditional news outlets and social media platforms determined to avoid being seen as abetting dirty tricks. Well, these gatekeepers believe they know what's best for you. And instead of sharing the ins and outs of professional investigative reporting, they are content to get people to take sides. And I don't like Fox News. I think it's done a great deal of damage to this country. But not everything they've reported about Hunter Biden's laptop, the emails contained within that show that Joe Biden, despite his claims otherwise, did meet with a top executive from Burisma, the Ukrainian energy company. And it was 2017 when Joe was out of office, kind of like Hillary taking all that money from Wall Street for speeches, when it appears that Joe did at least have knowledge of Hunter's efforts to generate new business from China. And it turns out, if you believe Tony Bobulinski, that Jim and Hunter Biden had business deals in a range of countries. We'll get to his commentary in a moment. So this was in Saturday's New York Times. And this is how they offer some honest reporting about the dark side of Hunter Biden while still claiming that none of this could possibly be true. Quote, "Some of the attacks are unfounded, but the facts of Hunter Biden's troubled life have provided the president with ample fodder. Hunter took a highly paid position with a Ukrainian oligarch regarded by the United States as corrupt, and later acknowledged he most likely got the job because his father was overseeing U.S. policy in the country at the time. He went into business with a number of partners who have subsequently been convicted of unrelated crimes. His struggles with addiction have contributed to the less admirable lines on his resume, including his abrupt departure from the Navy Reserve in 2014. Now, this is a cleaned-up version of Hunter's true history. They don't talk about the rent-a-car he returned with cocaine on the floor. But they do mention this. Hunter, now 50, has been the source of fatherly anguish as well as a Republican fixation. His struggles with drug and alcohol and messy family and business entanglements have been relentlessly chronicled. But that doesn't drive the New York Times to conclude that he is a corrupt individual who has traded on his father's name, and we're all told that we have to accept that Hunter never did anything wrong, Joe never did anything wrong. And the Times even gets a little tabloid here. After his big brother Beau died, Hunter became romantically involved with his brother's widow Hallie, creating a tabloid-ready humiliation and internal family fractures. So, this denial on the part of Democrats who are just so desperate to unseat Trump, and I understand that, But it does not, in my view, rationalize the media entering as gatekeepers saying, don't look at this. Nothing going on here. Oh, by the way, if you're tempted to look, it's Russian disinformation. And you're going to barf borscht if you read it. So one thing I want to note is that I did visit the Fox News website earlier today, and they haven't published anything about Tony Bobulinski or the Hunter Biden laptop for 5 days. I'm surprised by that, because I think that it has had an impact that's not measured in the polls, that has led people who were drifting away from Trump to say, well, he's the con man fraudster we know, and Joe Biden and Hunter, because they're liberals, you know, and you gotta play the liberals, that, you know, they then shifted back to the Trump sector. So I want to note that over the weekend, I overcame my own resistance, and I watched the Tucker Carlson interview with Bobulinski. And Tony Bobulinski is a kind of rigid former military guy who speaks in a kind of bureaucratic parlance. But he does offer damaging testimony about Joe Biden. That Joe Biden agreed to meet with him in an interlude that was arranged by Hunter on May 2nd of 2017. Then 11 days later, this email comes out about how we divvy up the money that we're anticipating from this deal with a Chinese energy firm. Now, you can't imagine that China was chasing Hunter Biden after his incredible work for Burisma in Ukraine. And while it appears that they never got much money out of this, maybe there was $5 million of seed money. But the claim by Trump that, you know, he got billions from China and that Joe got a share, this email does indicate that Joe was going to get a share. The big guy he was referred to as. And so I don't dismiss this out of hand. I put it in context of a political hit late in the campaign, clearly intended to roil the Biden campaign, distract from Trump and his family's own corruption. None of that is lost on me. But I cannot support efforts by the corporate media to suppress this and to try to tell us that, hey, you don't need to pay any attention to this because we have done that for you. And I want to recommend Caitlin Johnstone's column from October 28th. She watched the Tucker Carlson interview with Tony Bobulinski, too. She quoted the final comment, Carlson saying, I'm asking for your opinion as someone who's worked with the Chinese. If Biden is elected president, how does this constrain his ability to deal with China? The last words we hear from Bobulinski. So I think Joe Biden and the Biden family are compromised. And Johnstone picks up on that. And that is it. Beneath all the partisan noise and electoral implications, that is the message we were meant to take away from the interview. Not that the Biden family is corrupt. Not that Joe Biden lied about being uninvolved in his son's businesses. But that Joe Biden is compromised in favor of China. That is the story that's going to keep resurfacing. We are being played, she says. Paragraph later, she says, I don't know how or at what level, but we are being played. A narrative is being aggressively rammed down our throats about China in exactly the same way it was being aggressively rammed down our throats about Russia 4 years ago. Two unabsorbed nations, the U.S. government has long had plans to attack and undermine. Johnstone continues, Russiagate was never really about Trump, was never about his campaign staff meeting with Russians or a P-tape about an investigation into any kind of hidden loyalties to the Kremlin. Russiagate was about narrative managing the United States into a new Cold War with Russia, with the ultimate target being its far more powerful ally, China, and ensuring that Trump played along with that agenda. She says the strongest evidence against Russiagate was always the one fact neither Democrats nor Republicans ever wanted to look at and acknowledge, that Trump has, in fact, spent his entire term advancing many dangerous Cold War escalations against Moscow in the form of sanctions, shredded treaties, a more aggressive nuclear posture review, NATO expansion, arming Ukraine, attacking Russia's allies, and other measures which directly threaten the Russian Federation and undermine its interests. And if Biden gets in, she says, we can expect the same thing. A president who advances escalations against both Russia and China while being accused of the other party, by the other party, of being soft on China. Both parties will have their foot on the gas toward brinksmanship with a nuclear-armed nation with no one's foot anywhere near the brakes. Biden is corrupt, she asserts, but he is not compromised by China. So I think it's a very interesting insight on her part. And we will wait and see if she's on to something. So regarding Glenn Greenwald's resignation from The Intercept last week amid claims that he was being censored by the editors, his founding partner, Jeremy Scahill, issued a statement that was published on Sunday. And he said, first of all, I have watched and discussed over the past several days as a barrage of lies, smears, and vicious attacks has been unleashed against The Intercept and its journalists. Blah, 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 he says, what a fine outlet it is. Then he says, I don't always agree with my colleagues. I certainly don't agree with every story or viewpoint we publish, but I'm proud of our journalism and of the reporters and editors who work tirelessly to produce it. My fellow co-founder Glenn Greenwald has been a close friend and respected colleague for years. This is not an easy situation for me. Well, that's an understatement, Jeremy. From my perspective, he goes on, the recent incident with the Biden article that was followed by Glenn's resignation was part of a much broader conflict and difference of opinion. Neither Glenn nor I wanted to be anyone's boss, and we also didn't want to have bosses. That's a tough setup for a journalistic organization. There's always been a tension over our roles as founders versus those of editor-in-chief and other leadership. Over the years, I've often found myself in agreement with Glenn, and I also have had my strong disagreements with him. Now, let me pause to note that I believe Scahill wrote this himself, but it could have been crafted by a crisis PR person. He's splitting this baby right in half. He says, I do not agree with the characterization that Glenn alleged that he was censored. It seemed to me there was a reasonable path to publishing the article. Glenn clearly disagreed with that and decided to withdraw from that process. People can look at the materials Glenn published and make their own judgment. But Jeremy, he attacked The Intercept for its bungles with three different sources, including Reality Winner, who's in jail, an FBI informant who is on trial, and a guy who got burned in an article published by Jeremy Scahill. There's no mention of the role of Pierre Omidyar. There's no mention of whatever happened to the Snowden files. And there's no mention of Russiagate, which I think was the biggest divide between Greenwald and just about everybody else at The Intercept. Oh, and one more thing. Scahill doesn't address The Intercept's gross failings by publishing only two or three articles about the very critical hearings in London related to the extradition demand by the United States for Julian Assange. They had one piece before the trial, and Charles Glass, a friend of mine, did a wrap-up piece that was excellent. But over the weekend, in a Twitter post, Kevin Gostola said that he had repeatedly approached The Intercept about covering the Assange hearings for them, and Glenn Greenwald was advocating for him, but apparently the editors had misgivings about the image of Kevin Gostola, which I find ridiculous, but they're free to have their perceptions. So, Scahill closes by defending Betsy Reed. with whom he's worked for more than 15 years. She edited both of his books. And so that's what we got from Scahill. Want to recommend a piece by Elizabeth Voss, who is a very bright young journalist and observer, publishing at Consortium News today. She notes that if the mainstream media, and let's include The Intercept, had done decent coverage of the Assange extradition hearings, that it would not have benefited Donald Trump, but their blackout actually did. I'll put a link to her commentary in the podcast show file, and you can check it out. I also want to invite you, if you dare, to read Matt Taibbi's piece. It's a pox on both houses, but he makes a lot of important points, not only about Donald Trump, but also about Joe Biden. The article is headlined, "The Worst Choice Ever." And Taibbi closes by saying that he will not be voting for either candidate for president from the two major parties this year. Oh, and from Europe, BuzzFeed News quotes a bunch of unnamed government sources who are really disgusted by what they see happening in this election cycle here in the United States. And they close with a quote from a Ukrainian official who said their country will be pleased when the American election is finally over, and until then, they have one request. We don't want anything to do with your fucked up election. Keep us out of it, please. Then there's Trump, who is trying to deflect the rising death rate, the rising case numbers that almost hit 100,000 on Friday. That's the daily new cases of COVID. The rise in hospitalizations that is straining capacity in El Paso, Texas, in Wisconsin, in North Dakota, and a handful of other places. So he's trying to deflect that by, he's got this rap at his mob rallies, COVID, COVID, COVID. You turn on the TV, which he does all the time, and COVID, COVID, COVID. So he says that Joe Biden will impose a deadly lockdown and that he is going to save us all with a safe vaccine that ends the pandemic. So he's pumping blue sky on his side and total darkness from Biden. It's the false choice that's driven by fear that has really informed so much of his rhetoric. Here's a quote. The Biden plan will turn America into a prison state, locking you down while letting the far left rioters roam free to loot and burn. I wish I could just laugh, because it is funny in a sick and twisted way. But then he tells his cult followers, our doctors get more money if someone dies from COVID. You know that, right? I mean, our doctors are very smart people. And he imagines that they all think like he does. That to turn a bigger buck, you tell a bigger lie. He said, so if somebody's terminally ill with cancer and they have COVID, we report them. And you know, doctors get more money and the hospitals get more money. Think of this incentive. So this is a swift boat strategy. He is attacking the people who have risked their lives because he has failed so badly to manage this pandemic. And so he's attacking them on their greatest strength, that they treat patients and take risks, but of course they're doing it because they're greedy fuckers like he is. That's the way he thinks. So the numbers released on Friday for Thursday, 92,000 new cases. The numbers released on Saturday for Friday, it was just under 100,000. Then, as we have seen in the last 10 or 12 weeks, the numbers reported on Monday for Sunday drop. 74,000 new cases and 427 new deaths reported. And so we can expect that the caseload will remain close to 100,000 for the remainder of this week, and the death numbers will amp up to the range of at least 1,000 if the last few weeks are any indication. This study came out of Stanford, but not the right-wing Hoover institution that Scott Atlas came from. Oh, and Atlas is in big trouble because he gave an interview to RT, and he said he didn't know that was a Russian network. At any rate, this Stanford report was published on Friday. They didn't even issue a press release. They put it out to kind of technical medical networks, and they are estimating that Trump's mob rallies across the country this fall have infected at least 30,000 additional people and may have led to as many as 700 deaths. They collected and analyzed statistics in counties where 18 Trump rallies were held, only three of them indoors, to account for the problems of the changing nature of COVID. They compared their findings in each county where a rally took place to a comparable county that didn't have a Trump rally. And this doesn't appear to have any partisan leanings. It's just a forensic study. And it shows that Trump's rallies are super spreader events, that his idiot followers show up without masks and scream and shout in close quarters. They want to believe that they're invulnerable. Maybe that Trump's antibodies will somehow rub off on them. So Tony Fauci is again in the crosshairs of Trump. It appears that Trump is really pissed by an interview that Fauci gave the Washington Post. He reacted to Trump's frequent claim that we are rounding the turn, and he said, Fauci, the U.S. could not possibly be positioned more poorly to stem rising cases as more people gather indoors during the cold fall and winter months. The U.S. will need to make an abrupt change in public health precautions. And when asked about the two candidates, he said he believes that Biden is taking it seriously from a public health perspective, while Trump is looking at it from a different perspective of the economy and reopening the country. So at one of the mob rallies, I guess it was actually two of them over the weekend, Trump offered comments like Sunday in South Florida, where a crowd chanted, "Fire Fauci, fire Fauci." Yeah, that'll fix it. And Trump, of course, doing a Connie Chung. Yeah, Connie to Newt Gingrich is my reference here. "Don't tell anybody, but let me wait until a little bit after the election. I appreciate the advice." So he is suggesting that he will fire Fauci, as if that's going to end the pandemic. And, of course, he's claimed that Wednesday, when the voting is completed, we won't know the results, that that's when this whole thing goes away and the media will stop paying attention to it and he won't have to say COVID, COVID, COVID anymore. Well, this one's a little bizarre, and let me hasten to add that it's the only case we know of. But researchers in the United Kingdom performed an autopsy on a COVID-19 victim 27 days after he or she had died. And they found the COVID-19, the SARS-CoV-2, present in the lungs of that cadaver. And this is despite a nasal and throat swab taken after death that tested negative for the virus. They say the discovery may have a significant effect on the handling of laboratory specimens, as well as the disposal of the dead body. The individual, or the cadaver, if you will, had a medical history. A limited diagnostic autopsy was carried out 27 days later. Swabs were taken from his lungs, and that's where the virus was discovered. Contact tracing is pretty much hopeless at this stage, because as we hit almost 100,000 cases on Friday, it overwhelms the local officials who've been trying to figure out who gave COVID to whom. And in this report from the New York Times, they talk about 45-year-old Denny Taylor. He's in Omaha. He's currently in a hospital bed. He said, I was so careful, wearing a mask, getting groceries delivered. And he said he still has no idea where he caught it. And while early in the pandemic, like back in April and May, in Massachusetts, they launched their own. They hired new people to do contact tracing. And I have my issues with privacy matters. But bottom line is, if I had it, I would tell authorities who I had seen in the previous period of time, a week or two, to try to prevent further spread. I just don't want my cell phone used to turn me in or turn other people in. In North Dakota, state officials announced they can no longer have one-on-one conversations with everyone who may have been exposed. And the same in Philadelphia. Ed Snowden has made an application in Russia for dual citizenship for himself and his wife, Lindsay. They are expecting a child in late December. And Snowden says he wants to come home eventually. But because of the pandemics and closed borders, he and his wife are applying for dual U.S.-Russia citizenship. And this is made possible by a modification in Russian law that Putin signed back in May or so. And finally, The Guardian reports that there are many Americans who are making an exit plan. And I believe most of them would trigger it if Trump is re-selected for another 4 years. And I will concede that yours truly has a plan B. We were on a Zoom Halloween call with some friends. Several people expressed jealousy for a couple that moved to Vancouver, B.C. about 6 or 8 years ago. Another person on our party call said that if Trump gets another term, that she's going to pack up and move to Costa Rica. And we know that back in September during the presidential debate, there was a surge in Google searches. People wanting to know what the process is to move to Canada or to New Zealand. And so I don't want to discourage those kinds of thoughts. They travel through my brain too. And we will see in a few days or a few weeks if we need to develop further action plans on that in that direction. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment all the way to the end here. You can share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. And I am Peter B.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.